When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. This is episode 304, and I'm joined by the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baracchi. What's going on, dude?
Hey, doing all right. Status quo, although it seems I'm going into this podcast completely blind in all ways, so excited.
Yeah, you're welcome for that. Also, we're status post-Olympics. How are you feeling? You got a little, you know, post-Parisian blues or like how are we doing?
No, I mean, I enjoyed watching a lot of the different sports and activities. It seems like the U.S. had a phenomenal showing on the track in particular. In the pool was pretty good. I would say the women probably performed a bit stronger than the men did in the pool, but all around entertaining, impressive stuff.
Yeah. In fact, I had three highlights. These are not related to track or the pool. So I wanted to highlight them because they're important to either me personally or just, you know, my own interests. Sure. One, Nevin Harrison, she got silver in the sprint canoe. I think it's 200 meters. She was actually the reigning champion. She trains at my gym. Cool. This is a true story. I was squatting and I don't know, I think I had like 600 something on the bar, like a fair amount of weight. And she goes, "That's a lot of weight." And then I looked at what she was front squatting. It was 275. And I go, "No, that's a lot of weight." And so it was like game recognized game. And yeah, it turns out I was like, how is she so strong just out of the blue? I was like, What sport did you play? She's like, "Guess." Anyway, long story short, turns out she's Olympian. At Olympic level. I said rower originally, and she goes canoeist. And I go,
Yeah.
So anyway, she got silver. It was a photo finish. I think, you know, I may be biased, but I think she might have clipped her by a nudge. But, you know, hey, that's neither here nor there. Sure. Also, Hampton Morris broke the men's Olympic weightlifting curse. It's been over 40 years for a USA men's Olympic competitor to win a medal in Olympic weightlifting. He got the bronze in the 61 kilo class. And then Olivia Reeves, she won gold in the women's 71 kilo class, which, you know, for America not being good at Olympic weightlifting.
They finally figured it out. I mean, I can only imagine.
Probably low bar squatting.
Low bar squatting. There it is.
That's some humor. We don't think that, to be clear. These are hardworking individuals and they crushed it. Congratulations. Final shout out to Scotty Scheffler. He doesn't listen to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, but he did stage one of the most epic comebacks I've ever seen in golf. He was six shots down on the back nine, so nine holes to play. And he birdied five of six holes down the stretch, matched the course record, by the way, and then basically won the back-to-back gold for Team USA. Xander Schauffele won back in 2021 in Tokyo. So, yeah, we're just the best at golf. That's all there is. Go America, you know. Okay. Well, hey, before we do announcements, before we talk about some little headlines and then get into the meat of this week's podcast, let's just get into the case because I want to share with you the outline, the whole thing, and you are, as you said, going into this blind. So let's just get into the case.
Okay.
So this is a case study, and for those of you who are just tuning in to the Barbell Medicine Podcast for the first time, this is a real case, real patient. This really happened. And so, you know, if we make any jokes or laugh, it's not at the expense of the patient. It's just, you know, infotainment and such. But yeah, real stuff. And we're going to try to convey some practical pearls and let you inside Austin's brain. He's not on social media anymore. I mean, he's there. He's a ghost, really. The ghost of Austin is somewhere on social media, just lurking. But this allows us to take a peek into his cerebral cortex and enter his thought process. So without any further ado, also, I have to predict like whether or not you'll get this. I think you're going to get it. A 27-year-old man with no past medical history presents to the emergency department with severe weakness of both arms and legs that started about 6 hours ago. prior to this episode, the patient was participating in a bodybuilding show. Now, in preparation for this show, the patient says that he hasn't had any fluids for about 3 days. He's also been taking a diuretic, furosemide, 40 milligrams twice daily, in addition to trenbolone, boldenone, stenozolol, which is Winstrol, and testosterone at unknown doses that he purchased from a member at his gym. The patient says that this is the first time that this has ever happened, and he denies any recent trauma. His review of systems, which is basically a laundry list that doctors ask to sort of hone in on any maybe related signs or symptoms, well, it's significant for 2 weeks of what he describes as heart palpitations and insomnia. So before we go any further, any thoughts on this young gentleman?
Yes. So it seems like we have a previously healthy 27-year-old coming in with fairly diffuse weakness involving both arms and both legs for about 6 hours. And all of that context that you gave me in terms of bodybuilding show, decreased oral intake, anabolic use, diuretic use, et cetera. So we're trying to solve a case of, I would say, acute weakness here. And one of the ways that we think about this is it something that we can localize by way of evidence of a decrease in muscular strength in a particular area of the body, for example, one side or the other, an upper extremity or a lower extremity? Or is it more generalized? And if it's generalized, we want to know, is it more of just a subjective sensation of I'm feeling a little weak, I'm not feeling as strong as I usually do, or is there actual objective evidence of weakness and it's just kind of more diffuse? So this can lead us in all sorts of different directions, but the first kind of thought process is this something neurological? And so we think about what does it take to actually generate force in a particular arm or leg or, you know, area of the body? We need our brain to send a signal all the way down from the cortex to the subcortical areas, down the spinal cord, out the nerve roots from our spinal cord, down the peripheral nerves to the neuromuscular junction that then triggers the muscle itself to depolarize and then end up ultimately contracting, pulling on a tendon across a joint, and then moving something. That is top to bottom, the entire nerve axis. And that's how we would think about it. If somebody had, for example, a left leg that is weak, I would be thinking the whole path down to that leg. Again, here we have something all over the place, and it's acute in a previously healthy adult. And so that pathway ends up being a little bit less useful because you'd have to find something that explains simultaneous symmetric upper and lower extremity involvement, which is kind of less compatible with that kind of way of thinking about things. So instead, I'm thinking about something much more systemic, diffuse, that is impacting his ability to generate force. The one way, could he have something going on in his brain leading to this? Well, it would be difficult for him to have something in his brain causing all of his extremities to be weak and yet for him to be like awake and conscious in any way, right? So we're now much more pushed out to the periphery. Do we have something going on, for example, a polyneuropathy? All the nerves are affected. That's not very common. Something affecting his neuromuscular junctions. There are conditions like myasthenia gravis or botulism and things like that. Also not very common or likely in this demographic, in this scenario. Or is there something going on at his muscles themselves? He could have a muscular disease, although those don't typically manifest as acutely as this over the course of a couple hours, but there are other things that can impact the ability of your muscles to function on this time scale. And specifically, that would involve things like electrolyte abnormalities. So a very common situation that could lead to a syndrome like this is low potassium levels or hypokalemia. Our muscles maintain a kind of a normal electrical gradient by balancing out charges across the cell. So sodium is pushed out of cells, potassium is kept inside cells. And that gradient is really important for us to be able to, all of our cells and nerves included to function normally. Somebody who has not been drinking very much for several days, especially somebody who's using furosemide, which is a loop diuretic, that one of its many effects will be to specifically lead to loss of potassium in the urine. Fancy word for that is kaliuresis. And hypokalemia, low blood potassium levels, classically will manifest with this just kind of diffuse weakness. In severe cases, it could be essentially like a flaccid paralysis type thing. So in this situation, I would immediately want to get vital signs on this person and then check a blood chemistry level, mainly looking at potassium levels. This could be hypokalemia due to his oral intake, due to his diuretics. There are also other conditions like hypokalemic periodic paralysis, where your potassium levels can drop kind of almost spontaneously in the context of exercise or eating high carbohydrate meals and things like that, and lead to this kind of sudden onset paralysis effectively in people who are otherwise, generally healthy. So that's kind of where I'm thinking first.
Okay, well, ask and ye shall receive. So in the emergency department, his vital signs were significant for a blood pressure to 193 over 78. He had an elevated heart rate to 109, 109 beats per minute, but otherwise were unremarkable. No fever, breathing fine on room air. On physical exam, the patient appears anxious but is able to give a history and participate in the exam. His eye exam is significant for bilateral lid lag with downward gaze. His examination of the extremities showed a fine tremor in both hands at rest and with movement, and his strength was 2 out of 5 in both upper and lower extremities. His reflexes were normal. His capillary refill was also normal, and his cardiopulmonary exam was unremarkable. The EKG, however, showed T-wave inversions in the inferior leads and U-waves. His laboratory analysis in the emergency department was significant for the following. He was hypokalemic, so low potassium, 1.9, where the reference range is 3.7 to 5.2. He also had low phosphate, so hypophosphatemia, 0.9, when the normal range was 2.5 to 4.5, and his blood sugar was 128. Urinary tox screen was negative. Before we go on, any thoughts based on that sort of presentation?
Yeah, useful. So it is interesting that he's that hypertensive, his blood pressure is that high in the context of supposedly not taking in much fluids and being on a diuretic for several days. So that leads me to be suspicious of other things that can kind of crank up your sympathetic activity, your adrenergic tone to crank up your blood pressure like that. Is there some sort of endogenous from within his body or exogenous source of kind of a stimulant type thing that could include something like thyroid hormone or catecholamine hormones? Something like that. When I go to his exam, the findings of him looking anxious, having the eye findings, that finding called lid lag, which is a little bit difficult to describe in words. I would YouTube it if you want to see what that looks like, him having a fine tremor. All of that is very suggestive, again, of this kind of hypersympathetic activated state, which is most classically going to be associated with elevated thyroid hormone levels or thyrotoxicosis. And that, again, can come from either his own thyroid gland that is overactive or some kind of exogenous or outside the body source of thyroid hormone that is coming in at doses higher than his body needs, if it needs any at all. And so I do have some concerns about some of his various supplements, for example, that he could be taking that could be contaminated, say, with T3 or T4 thyroid hormone, which is often used to facilitate weight loss, for example. That would be a not unusual thing to see here. The EKG looks like he has low blood potassium levels. All of those findings, T-wave inversions and U-waves, are all typical for hypokalemia, which I would have predicted when you gave me those lab numbers of low potassium, which he's probably losing to some extent in his urine from the diuretic. But also, if he does have this hyperactive kind of thyrotoxic state, for example, too much thyroid hormone, that actually is just it's like stepping on the accelerator for your metabolism. It cranks up metabolic rate. It cranks up the activity of your sodium-potassium pumps, and that can drive potassium into cells. There's a lot of different ways that can happen, and this is one of them. So overall, at this point, I'm most concerned for, the cause of his weakness now is solved. We know why he's weak. It's from the hypokalemia. Potassium of 1.9 is extremely low. He needs to be in a monitored setting and get that replaced, you know, at a safe but semi-aggressive rate as that potassium gets back up into the high twos, into the threes, his strength will come back in his arms and legs. I'm quite confident of that. If we feed him, his phosphate will also come up. But I would also next be curious about checking a thyroid panel. This again can help us see, does he have too much thyroid hormone coming from within his body, like from Graves' disease or something? I'm not thinking that that's as likely here, but it's possible. Does he have exogenous thyroid hormone coming in, like, for example, from one of his contaminated supplements? And then once we figure that out as the most likely kind of next thing, then there would be some additional medical treatments that we could use to kind of tamp that down, put him on, you know, beta blockers and other things to help get that under control while we figure out what the next best steps are, depending on where this excess thyroid hormone is coming from, given that that's my leading suspicion right now.
Well, again, ask and ye shall receive. So there is a thyroid panel that was made available. His TSH level, so thyroid stimulating hormone, was undetectable. He had a normal T3 level. He had an elevated T4 level of 3.6, where the normal range is 0.8 to 1.9. His thyroid antibodies were normal, and he had a radioactive iodine uptake assay done, and that was at 1%, whereas the normal is 8 to 25%. So his thyroid's not really taking up a bunch of iodine. So with all that information, your clinical reasoning so eloquently put, do you have a diagnosis here, Dr. Baraki?
I'm most concerned for exogenous use of thyroxine. supplementation in some form coming into his body. This would be, if I'm thinking through this in real time here, I mean, the other possibility that we can sometimes see is somebody having acute thyroiditis where their thyroid gland is getting destroyed and it is spontaneously releasing a bunch of thyroxin or T4 into the blood. That can also lead to a suppressed TSH, a normal T3, and you would not have a ton of uptake on your scan. However, that's usually more of an autoimmune destruction type phenomenon. You might have some elevated antibodies. Not a perfect kind of case there, but those would be the main two possibilities. And I'm more suspicious for exogenous supplementation. You know, he's got some thyroxin in something he's taking versus less likely thyroiditis.
Yep. The patient did admit to taking an unknown supplement from his coach, which according to the coach, when contacted, contained an unknown amount of thyroid hormone they thought was T4. The diagnosis made on the spot was thyrotoxic periodic paralysis, secondary to exogenous thyroid hormone intake, also complicated by dehydration and diuretic use. He was admitted and treated with IV saline, magnesium, phosphate, and potassium early in his admission and then observed for 48 hours. Blood pressure, potassium, TSH, and T4 all normalized, and the patient was discharged on hospital day 3. Although he was lost to follow-up, which unsurprising here. No mention also if he won the bodybuilding show, like unclear. But so the pearls on this one, my takeaway here, first, in general, most coaches are not doctors. We kind of have this privilege of being physicians and also, you know, doing some coaching. But most coaches, by and large, are not doctors or pharmacists. And if they were, they would tread very carefully around recommendations regarding supplements, particularly around the thyroid axis and otherwise. You know, even if they were trying to do their due diligence here, imagine like an informed consent. Hey, man, here's an unknown supplement with unknown amounts of thyroid hormone. You should take it, and we're going to like monitor you periodically based on these things. Most of the stuff, these protocols, if you will, are made up and can certainly be dangerous, particularly with, you know, this hyperthyroidism that he, you know, it's almost like a thyroid storm, thyrotoxicosis from taking it too much. And with, you know, excess thyroid hormone, this thyrotoxic periodic paralysis due to supplementation is also called thyrotoxicosis factitia. So effectively, people are just taking it, you know, on their own. There are 7 cases in the literature on this, all from weight loss supplements. One was titled The Killer Bees Fat Burner, which basically when you buy that, you just assume that you're going to, you know, go into thyroid storm from that. The second one, the supplement was called Metabolic Accelerator, and they were both contained a thyroid hormone or analog. 5 cases were in men, which is actually the opposite of the normal distribution. Most hyperthyroidism cases are in women. And there's thought to be this effect of testosterone perhaps on the sodium potassium ATPase pump, perhaps making men more like sensitive to dosing yourself with too much thyroid. Whereas in like people who are not taking this, maybe more women tend to get it than men. I just thought that this was super interesting. I mean, thyrotoxic periodic paralysis is pretty much well characterized, but as you pointed out in the very first part of this case, sudden onset, it's not progressive like other forms of myopathy. And this is usually due to low potassium. So basically you have high thyroid floating around in the bloodstream. You get more sodium and potassium ATPase channels in the skeletal muscle that are doing their thing. Now, normally these ion channels remove sodium from the inside of the cell and put potassium into the cell. And when you got a bunch of thyroid floating around, well, that goes into overdrive. And then you don't have as much potassium on the outside of the cell, which makes it difficult for the muscles to basically respond to a neurological signal and contract. And so this guy, you know, actually had to be removed from his home. He couldn't get up and like walk into the ambulance. He needed help. So would not recommend supplementing yourself with thyroid hormone. Also, if you're hearing this, you're like, well, potassium seems super important. I should probably just, you know, take some potassium. Also would recommend against routine potassium supplementation unless your doctor is otherwise advising you to do so and monitoring you. Any additional insight there?
Yeah, I agree. You could die if you end up taking a bunch of potassium that you don't need. That's one of the things they use in like lethal injection when they're executing people is potassium because it stops your heart if you become elevated at way too high levels. Pretty straightforward, you know, presentation and case. This would be actually pretty easy to manage in the hospital over the course of a couple days. I would point out that, you know, classically, the condition known as hypokalemic periodic paralysis, I think that's thought to be more of a genetically mediated thing where this is not usually in the context of people taking thyroid hormones. So I would not have diagnosed this patient as hypokalemic periodic paralysis because that's something that the periodic element of it, these people have just like spontaneous bouts of weakness that comes on, again, typically in the context of either exercise or after like high carbohydrate meals, whereas this was much more clearly provoked by his supplementation. So maybe that thyrotoxicosis factitia that you mentioned, that sounds like a better label for this than the umbrella diagnosis of hypokalemic periodic paralysis. But that's a kind of detail. But yeah, good case, straightforward.
Yeah. All right. Well, I didn't want to bury the lead here, but we're going to talk about the thyroid in this podcast, but not hyperthyroid. We're going to do a separate episode on that. We're going to talk about hypothyroid. Okay. Before we get into this week's podcast, a few announcements here. One, we have calculators available on our website. So if you go over to barbellmedicine.com, you click on About Us, you click on the resources page. There's a bunch of free calculators there, everything from like a one rep max calculator to how many calories you're supposed to get in a day to your heart rate zones for the five zones of conditioning. It's all there. It's all free. You can check that out. Also, if you have an Android phone, all of our templates are available on the Android app now. We got our Barbell Medicine app there, so you can check that out. It's free to download, and you get a free first week of any template. So if you're having like shoulder pain, knee pain, low back pain, or you're trying to get the most out of your training, we got you covered there. And if you want to try a template before you commit to it, all the first weeks are available for free there. We have a template quiz available also on our website. So if you're wondering which template to pick, we have a quiz that basically takes my brain, put it into an algorithm, and you can answer a few questions and arrive at that answer. And we do have a few new templates coming out. The first one that's just available now is the push-pull legs template. Now, people were asking, like, hey, could you do a push-pull legs template? I know that it's not your favorite sort of training split, but could you do it? Because I love it. I'm like, fine. So here's what I did. Beta tested it in about 50 different people and kind of came up with this. There's a power building one, which is more geared towards people who want to get stronger in the big three, the bench press, the squat, the deadlift. And then there's a hypertrophy focused one, which is pure hypertrophy work, but set up in that push-pull legs sort of training distribution. So that's available. And it's much less expensive than our other templates. So this is sort of like an on-ramp, a gateway drug, if you will, into the Barbell Medicine ecosystem. So you can check that out either on the app or on our website. Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. Summer is here, and that means a lot of you are going to want to spend more time outside and less time on meal prep, all while staying on track with your nutrition. For many, a meal prep service like Factor can bridge that gap. I've been using Factor for a while now, just here and there when I'm spending more time away from home or don't have time to cook, and it's made my day delicious and easy. Meals are ready in just 2 minutes, and they have everything from breakfast to dinner and even dessert, so you can stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. They also have 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons. I am a creature of habit, but there's a lot of different stuff to choose from, so you'll always have new flavors to explore. So head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When you need to work quickly and confidently across different apps and platforms, consistent quality communication is key. Whether you're writing documents, emails, or presentations, you need Grammarly. It's an AI writing partner that helps you get your work done faster with better writing. It's always there to help because it works where you work, across 500,000 apps and websites, so you can get more done no matter where you're writing. Grammarly is the gold standard of responsible AI, trusted by millions of professionals for 15 years. It gives you personalized writing suggestions based on your audience, goals, and context, plus tone suggestions to help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. 96% of users agree Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Okay, we're here on episode 304 with Dr. Austin Baracchi. We're going to talk about hypothyroidism. Now, our case referred to hyperthyroidism from exogenous thyroid ingestion. But in this week's podcast, we'll talk about hypothyroidism. And thyroid hormone, as you may have learned during the case report, is critically important as it affects pretty much every organ system in the body, including the heart, brain, muscle, skin, and your metabolism. It increases your basal metabolic rate at the cellular level. I like when other podcasters say cellular level, like it's some sort of flex, but like legitimately, that's what the thyroid hormone does. So I couldn't think of a better way to put that. It also stimulates bone growth and remodeling. It's important for brain development in the prenatal period and mood status in adults. It even plays a role in type 2 or fast twitch muscle development. So it's important to a whole host of things. Now, Austin, what's the most common thing that you see in the hospital relating to the thyroid?
In the hospital, it's actually relatively infrequent for the thyroid to be a major issue that I deal with day to day. Most run-of-the-mill hypothyroidism, even most run-of-the-mill hyperthyroidism, can be managed in the outpatient world. But sometimes I'll end up needing to admit a patient for a much more severe manifestation of thyroid disease, like more severe thyrotoxicosis, like if they have bad Graves' disease. I just made a diagnosis of this about 4 or 5 weeks ago. Woman who came in, she was sweating, hot all the time, having rapid heart rates into the 140s and 150s that weren't coming down, various other findings. And then some in less common scenarios, patients who have severe hypothyroidism, low thyroid function to the point where they're practically comatose. In order to be sick enough to need to be in the hospital for your thyroid, you need to be pretty much at one of the extremes. So thyroid storm, which is life-threatening, it can kill you. And then the other end, which is called myxedema coma or severe hypothyroidism, where you're kind of obtunded and not doing a whole lot. But most of the time, the thyroid is not my primary concern in most of the people that I see in the hospital setting.
Yeah, it's there. It's an organ and they may have an issue with it, but generally not the reason they're admitted unless on one of the extremes.
Yeah.
For this podcast, we're going to talk about what happens when people don't have enough thyroid hormone. We'll do another podcast on what happens if you have too much thyroid hormone, like our case study. But let's first start with some basic anatomy and physiology. So anatomy-wise, the thyroid gland sits midline, so in the center, in the front of the neck, in front of the voice box or larynx, right around C5 to T1 vertebra. And generally speaking, the thyroid gland has two symmetrical lobes connected by an isthmus, though there are a number of different variations that people can have. So for example, people can have portions of the thyroid gland anywhere from the tongue to the diaphragm. It's basically its migratory path during development. I could not find a case of anybody with like a diaphragmatic like thyroid lobe or something, or like a lingual thyroid lobe, but apparently that can happen. From a physiology perspective, the thyroid gland is part of the endocrine system, which means it is a tissue that produces hormones. These are chemical messengers, and it releases them into the bloodstream. And these chemical messengers go on to modify, regulate, and otherwise influence the function of cells, organs, and tissues at distant sites, so throughout the body. For the physiology of the thyroid itself, now this starts all at the hypothalamus, which is a small structure deep within your brain, and it produces thyroid releasing hormone, which signals to the pituitary gland to produce thyroid stimulating hormone, which is also known as TSH. We've already referenced that in our case study for this podcast. Now, TSH stimulates the thyroid gland itself to do its thing and produce thyroid hormones, although the thyroid gland itself actually produces three separate hormones. One is tetraiodothyronine, that's T4, that's inactive thyroid hormone. It's about 90% of what the thyroid gland produces. It's later converted to either an active form in the periphery, so in the bloodstream, or an alternative inactive form. There's also triiodothyronine, that's T3, that's active thyroid hormone, and that's about 10% of what the thyroid gland produces. And there's a third hormone called calcitonin that's mainly involved in calcium and bone metabolism. Now, T3 and T4 are the typical thyroid hormones that you hear about, so we'll focus on those for the remainder of the podcast, specifically when they're low, as in hypothyroidism, so low thyroid hormones. Normal functioning of the thyroid is maintained by a negative feedback loop where high levels of T3 and T4 decrease thyroid stimulating hormone, that's TSH, released from the pituitary gland, and low levels of T3 and T4 increase TSH release. So you can now predict what happened to the patient in our case study. His T4 was sky high from supplementing, and accordingly, his TSH was appropriately shut off, so undetectable in the blood. Similarly, individuals with low thyroid hormone levels, well, we'd expect a high TSH in response to return thyroid hormones back to normal. That's provided that their pituitary gland is working correctly and their thyroid gland is working correctly as well. Okay, so let's move on to some more hypothyroid-specific sort of discussion, including a definition. I've already kind of alluded to this, that hypothyroidism means that the thyroid gland can't make enough thyroid hormone to keep the body running as it should. Now, there are many different causes of hypothyroidism, and it can show up in different ways. It can be subtle, as is seen in subclinical hypothyroidism. And by definition, there are no symptoms. Otherwise, if you had symptoms, it would be overt hypothyroidism. And so things with obvious signs and symptoms with corroborating laboratory evidence, that's called either clinical hypothyroidism or sometimes overt hypothyroidism. And this can also occur in a very transient or short-term setting. That can be acute thyroiditis or painless thyroiditis, as it's sometimes called. And it can occur from an issue anywhere in the sort of system. So from the hypothalamus, that deep structure in the brain, the anterior pituitary gland, the thyroid gland itself, though it's most commonly in the thyroid gland, which is called primary hypothyroidism. It can also occur from medications like lithium, metoclopramide as well, a few other things that can affect thyroid hormone production. The most common cause of hypothyroidism in developed countries is Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which is a primary disease of the thyroid gland due to the patient's own body attacking the thyroid gland and destroying the thyroid cells via antibodies. Now, in developing countries, the most common cause is dietary iodine deficiency. And it's not because they're all just consuming like sea salt, for example, or like Himalayan, goat urine crystallized salt. It's just because they don't have a lot of iodine in the food that they're consuming. So kind of depends on where you're at. If you were in a developing country and you saw somebody with a big goiter, for example, you wouldn't be thinking, it's probably Hashimoto's. You'd be thinking iodine deficiency. But if you're in California or where you live and you saw somebody with a hypothyroidism, goiter or not, you're thinking, man, this is probably Hashimoto's until proven otherwise. As far as symptoms of hypothyroidism, it's highly variable. It depends on the severity. So like, again, if you had somebody with effectively no circulating thyroid hormone, they might be in that myxedema coma condition that you mentioned earlier. And it also depends on what age this presents at, like kids versus adults. Kids, there's a lot of developmental signs and symptoms that can present. Whereas in adults, which we'll focus on, this most commonly presents with fatigue, muscle weakness and pain, particularly slow movement, delayed reflexes, weight gain. And people will talk about this all the time. Oh, my thyroid's, out of whack. And that's why I'm gaining weight. It's mostly fluid weight, however. So you certainly can gain weight from hypothyroidism, but it's mostly water weight. We'll discuss that in more detail later. Also, cognitive dysfunction. So that just means your brain's not working how it should. And that typically results with slowed speech, constipation, skin changes like dry, coarse, or scaly skin, menstrual irregularities, and also potentially a goiter, which is basically an enlargement of the thyroid gland in the anterior neck itself. Now, these signs and symptoms would generally trigger laboratory evaluation. So if you went to your doctor and you're like, hey, man, I'm tired. I feel like I'm moving more slowly. I've gained some weight. You might say like cold intolerance, for example. A doctor would be like, oh, well, hey, sorry you're experiencing that. Let me run some tests here. And one of those tests would probably be related to your thyroid function. Now, Austin, you don't work in the primary care settings. You're not seeing people outside of the hospital. Once people have made it through, either their primary care provider, the urgent care, or through the ED, and they see you, they've generally been worked up to some degree. But when you think about ordering thyroid labs and like the appropriateness, like, I don't know, how do you think about that?
I certainly do some primary care consultation, but yeah, most of my work is in the hospital setting. And by the time I'm seeing people, honestly, it's sometimes amusing because I can pretty much reliably look at their prior labs unless they've like never seen a doctor and they come in. Otherwise, most people have had like numerous TSHs checked in their chart. It is something that I would argue for a lot of people is probably overchecked in terms of frequency. It's not that it's incorrect to check it, but if you have one and it's normal, unless there's some insane dramatic change over the course of, a few weeks or a couple months, you don't need it rechecked like a month or two later, right? But the main situations where I would get it is any of the suggestive clinical symptoms that you mentioned, which, as you probably pointed out, are a lot of them are pretty nonspecific, right? Things like fatigue and things like that, which may not be the, on its own, a sole manifestation of hypothyroidism most of the time, but it is a cheap, inexpensive, pretty reliable test to check. And so it is often checked in those kind of contexts with those suggestive clinical symptoms, even though that many of them are nonspecific. There are certain other clinical scenarios that would prompt me to check it. So sometimes I'll do it in the context of significant lipid abnormalities, blood cholesterol panels being abnormal, certain electrolyte abnormalities, mainly having to do with sodium, although I can't say that I've ever actually confidently diagnosed a pure hypothyroid hyponatremia. It is elusive. Certain muscle diseases like myopathies, if somebody has a known or suspected disorder affecting their pituitary gland, because that's where TSH comes from. If they have panhypopituitarism, for example, or if I'm worried about that. And then lots of other specific clinical contexts, including to what you mentioned earlier, if I'm about to start a medicine on somebody that is known to impact thyroid function like lithium or amiodarone, those would be situations where I'd want to check those levels before I got going.
Now, I know that hypothyroidism is associated with the myopathy, so greater risk of not only muscle pain, muscle weakness, but also like elevated CK creatine kinase levels. I don't know this, but you can clue me in. When somebody comes in with rhabdomyolysis or you suspect rhabdomyolysis, are you routinely getting a TSH just to like rule it out? Or is that more like, I have no idea why you got this. You don't have a good story, so we're getting a TSH just to rule that out.
Correct. A clear case of exertional rhabdomyolysis, I would just treat as exertional rhabdomyolysis and move on. If somebody is coming in and with an unexplained syndrome of myopathy, and the time course would fit as well, then I would consider checking a TSH. And what I mean by that is with exertional rhabdo, for example, people typically feel fine, they overdo it suddenly, and then they come in with this sudden syndrome that then tends to respond to treatment pretty well with fluids, they get back to normal, they go. If I'm thinking of somebody who has another cause of myopathy or myositis that is not due to a clear exertional like provoked episode, they're usually going to come in not with an abrupt onset, right? So thyroid myopathy, it is not terribly common, but when it does happen, it is not abrupt. It's going to be more what we call kind of subacute. It's going to be something that kind of smoldering gradually comes on over the course of like weeks to months, and they might gradually notice themselves getting weaker or less able to do the things they want. And then the degree of elevation of creatine kinase would not be typically as high as we might sometimes see in exertional rhabdomyolysis most of the time. So that would be a situation where I might check that. I would also be looking for other features too, because it would not be expected for somebody to just have like only the muscle findings and nothing, no other findings suggestive of hypothyroidism. So like if they had the muscle findings and they had a slow heart rate and their EKG had like, some changes that I'd look for there, they were, losing the outer parts of their eyebrows and some other findings like that, slow reflexes, all that would paint a stronger and stronger and stronger picture for it. But that kind of gradual building up on, time frame and otherwise not a clear, obvious explanation or provoking factor would be the time I would check it, not in an acute exertional scenario.
Yeah, makes sense. You don't need to just check it just to cross it off the list unless there's a good reason to. Mm-hmm. As far as epidemiology goes, the incidence of Hashimoto's, now this is one type. It is the most common type of hypothyroidism, but not the only cause. But the incidence of Hashimoto's is about 0.8 per 1,000 individuals per year in men and 3.5 cases per 1,000 per year in women. So the women definitely tend to have this more. The overall incidence of hypothyroidism of all causes is between 0.1 to 2%. For that sort of clinical syndrome, so with symptoms, whereas subclinical, again, no symptoms, but maybe some abnormal laboratory findings, may affect up to 10% of adults. Now, in a survey of over 13,000 U.S. adults without known thyroid disease or family history of thyroid disease, overt or that clinical hypothyroidism was found in 0.3% of the sample. Effectively, these folks were identified via laboratory analysis and then called to make sure that they had symptoms. So yeah, about 0.3% for all cause of hypothyroidism. As far as risk factors for Hashimoto's in particular, again, this is the most common cause of hypothyroidism in developed countries. Genetics seems to be the biggest lever here. It shows up to about 80% of the sort of risk due to genetics. Age, yes, there's an increased prevalence with age. There's been some discussion of like environmental causes. Most people, especially if you spend a lot of time on social media, which I do not recommend based on my own sort of sanity and will to live, people will say stress. Oh, I'm stressed out. My thyroid's on the fritz because I'm stressed. This is actually more linked to hyperthyroidism, so too high of a thyroid function like Graves' disease, and also usually associated with prolonged course from or Hashimoto's is usually from a prolonged course of thyroid destruction that reaches a critical mass. So stress is usually more short-term, right? Acute onset or whatever. Whereas Hashimoto's has a more prolonged course. So it's not like, oh, I'm suddenly stressed. Now my thyroid's on the fritz. If anything, more stress is going to cause more thyroid to be released and you can get that hyperthyroidism sort of state. Radiation, though, is in the environment and that can certainly be a cause. Chernobyl comes to mind immediately. And also sex. Again, more women are affected than men, and also a risk happens to be pregnancy as well, which is a women-specific sort of condition. Now, as far as labs go, we alluded to this earlier. These can be useful, though, again, this is mostly related to people having signs and symptoms that would warrant a sort of workup here, not just, I went to the doctor, they decided to like request some labs, and TSH was added onto that. That's generally not high-value care, although you and I both know that does happen. Like, oh, I haven't seen you in a few years. Let's get, you know, a standard chemistry. Let's get a lipid panel. Let's get an A1C. All of those things we could say, eh, that's probably fine. Maybe a complete blood count. And then people say, yeah, I'll throw a TSH in there and a vitamin D level too. And you're like, dang it. Why though?
Yeah, exactly. Not a situation where that needs to be done.
And further, there's controversy over what a normal TSH level is. Now, the typical limits, if you go into the current guidelines, the ATA and the AACE guidelines, the typical upper limit for TSH is 4.5, although some individuals have suggested that the true upper limit should only be 2.5 to 3.5 in healthy individuals without thyroid disease. And others still argue that the TSH distribution should actually go upwards as people age, so you should have like age-specific TSH levels. It's still controversial. It's an active area of debate, and I don't pretend to be like an expert in TSH levels, but it is an active area of controversy.
Yeah, I'm typically a bit more liberal with what I think is fine for a TSH level in somebody who has no signs or symptoms and as they're getting older. And so I do let that upper range kind of drift upward as people get older, as long as they say they feel fine and they have no deficits or problems. And then the other end of the spectrum is that we actually would tend to target lower levels in the context of pregnancy to reduce the risk of certain fetal outcomes. So those TSH targets tend to be pushed down. We would not prefer somebody who's pregnant to be running through their whole pregnancy with a TSH of 4. Rather, it'd be nicer if it were down closer to 2, for example. But yeah.
There's also biological variation in people's TSH levels day to day, which we've talked about before in relationship to testosterone, also clinical variations in the test itself. And so some people will like use TSH as a sort of marker of like health, for example, and they're otherwise asymptomatic. And they're like, oh, my TSH went down, which means my thyroid hormones must be higher, which means I must be healthier. And it's like, nah, it might just be a standard error in the test. Particularly if someone's asymptomatic, I'm like, well, why are you testing not only your TSH, but all other thyroid hormones, you know, on a regular basis anyway? Maybe you just refer back to our screening podcast for our general thoughts on like, you know, checkups involving labs. But overall, people with clinical or overt sort of primary hypothyroidism, again, that's too low of a thyroid function, well, they're going to have low T4 and high levels of TSH. That means that their pituitary gland is responding and pumping out thyroid stimulating hormone in order to bring their thyroid hormone levels back up. People who have subclinical, so again, this is asymptomatic sort of hypothyroidism, well, they'll have a generally high TSH level and normal free T4 levels. Again, it's mostly asymptomatic. As far as another cause can be central hypothyroidism. This is basically when the pituitary gland is not getting the signal from the hypothalamus. Well, they'll have a low T4 level. That means the thyroid gland itself is not pumping out enough T4, and their TSH level may vary. Basically, the anterior pituitary gland may or may not be putting out enough TSH. It really depends on the level of function above that, which is that deep structure in the brain called the hypothalamus. Now, what happens if you get an abnormal TSH result? So if it's high, then you go back again to the doctor and you get another TSH level with this time with free T4. And that free T4 level sort of directs where you go. If the free T4 is also low, you're like, this looks like hypothyroidism. We need to replace that. If the free T4 level is normal, you're like, that's interesting. And you investigate further. If it's high, you're like, oh, let's investigate even further. So that free T4 is kind of like the decides where you go on the algorithm. If TSH is low, then you go back and you get another TSH level. You also get free T4 and this time T3 and figure out where you go. This can also be due, interestingly, to some listeners, particularly of the fairer sex. If you're a woman and you're listening to this and you take biotin as a supplement, perhaps for your hair, nails, or skin. And I'm not saying that that works, but I know that people do this. This can interfere with the actual test for TSH and also the test for free T4 and T3. So they'll generally ask people to stop taking a biotin supplement for a couple of days and then retest just to make sure that that's not messing with the test. Now, this is the Barbell Medicine Podcast, so we have to talk about exercise. Now, exercise typically does not alter thyroid stimulating hormone, TSH, or free T4 or T3, so it doesn't really affect the thyroid hormones. Now, during exercise, if you are taking a blood draw, and there are actually studies that do this, they have people do like intervals for a couple of minutes, and then they do a blood draw, and they keep doing the intervals, take another blood draw, just to see what happens with T3 and T4. Well, they generally go up during exercise, as these are thought to be involved in energy sort of liberation, like, oh, I need energy to exercise, I need glucose, I need lipids or whatever. And sure, T3 and T4 will go up, just like cortisol and other sort of stuff, as a method to give you energy, though the turnover of these hormones also increase. So your body is basically consuming them on some level. So TSH may spike as a result, depending on how long the exercise was. Although generally, if you are exercising for that long or that intensely, you'll also be sweating. So some of that may be due to hemoconcentration. Effectively, you've sweated out enough fluid that TSH level looks artificially high.
Yeah, I mean, this is not something that ever really comes up clinically, where we're obviously monitoring people's hormone levels, like in the immediate context of exercise. So kind of more of a, that's interesting than anything useful.
I was just curious what happens with exercise. Yeah, but totally. In general, these are short-term changes, mm-hmm. and they tend to resolve within a day. So if you're like, hey, my thyroid panel is very important to me because I've been dealing with this hypothyroidism, I don't feel like it's been adequately managed, or I'm very sensitive to changes, and you want to make sure that you get accurate laboratory work, probably don't exercise the day that you get your thyroid level drawn, at least before the test anyway. Sure.
Sure.
There is no evidence, and this is important for people thinking about, like, damn, you guys are talking about thyroid hormone. I need to get a prescription for these labs. I need to go do direct to consumer laboratory analysis. Like, what do? So there's no evidence that early detection and treatment with T4 actually improves clinically important outcomes in asymptomatic individuals. Effectively, if it's not broke, don't fix it. If you're like, well, now I'm just curious, and even if you did find something and you were subsequently treated with levothyroxine, so synthetic T4, there's no evidence that actually improves any sort of outcome that we care about, whether it's reduction in heart disease, improvement of blood lipids, whatever. That doesn't happen. So effectively, if you're asymptomatic, maybe don't care about your thyroid. I've never thought about my thyroid, not once.
Yeah, it's a luxury that we can go about our lives not worrying about it. So I wouldn't recommend worrying about it if you feel fine.
And if you can't just take our word for it, well, you could take a tip from the ATA, the AACE, that's the American Academy of Clinical Endocrinologists, the AAFP, and the USPSTF. These are all like major health organizations. None of them recommend routine screening for thyroid abnormalities in those without any sort of signs or symptoms. Now, if you do have a sign or symptom, hey, that's a totally different situation. We'll gladly, you know, send you to the lab, get some blood work. But if you're asymptomatic, hey, carry on. Now, Austin, when you think about treatment of hypothyroidism, you know, is it just as simple as like, hey, let's replace the hormone and that's it, you're good to go?
Yeah, this is something where you really want to have a confident sense of what's causing this condition so that you can treat it most appropriately. And so when it comes to the most common cause of primary hypothyroidism that you alluded to in kind of the, like in the US, for example, which is that autoimmune attack on the thyroid gland. Unfortunately, relatively little that we can do to, you know, turn that off and reverse that type of pathology. And so those patients typically end up on lifelong thyroid hormone replacement. Certainly, if you have a disease higher up, like if your disease is not in the thyroid gland itself, but you have a problem with your pituitary functioning, you're definitely going to need thyroid hormone replacement, as well as probably numerous other hormones that your pituitary kind of signals or delivers to the body. So that would be another important reason to figure out, is this primary, is the second, where is the problem leading to insufficient thyroid hormone? There are some situations where you end up not actually needing it. For example, if patients have that transient thyroiditis, which can sometimes happen, you get a viral infection, you get a little bit of some soreness in the front of your neck, you get some symptoms either of hyper or hypothyroidism. There is a fraction of people who undergo that in whom their function ends up returning to baseline over time, and it can stay there. Others might return to baseline, and then, you know, a few months or years later, they might actually develop overt hypothyroidism. You just kind of have to see what happens. And there's not a ton that you can do to kind of alter that trajectory. So there are many that need lifelong thyroid hormone replacement, some that might resolve to baseline without it. You'd also have to think about, again, do we have them on any of these medicines that can cause this? And do we need to alter that plan of care? And that's usually done with thyroid hormone levothyroxine, or the T4 component. That's a nice, stable kind of medication to give people in terms of its duration. So when you give somebody a dose of that, it tends to hang around and last and have its effect for at least a week. And so that gives you nice, steady kind of coverage with that. Some patients, kind of more anecdotally, and I think there's some preliminary research on this, feel a bit better if you give them a combination of T4 and T3. T3 or leothyronine is a much, much, much shorter acting form of the thyroid hormone. It's the more active form and a very short acting form. So if it's going to be dosed, it's more often dosed twice a day. And that's just because of its much shorter duration of action. This is a more complex management approach that I would say is a bit beyond the scope of our podcast today, but just speaking to it, that it is a thing that exists out there in case there's a listener who's on it and is like, what is my doctor doing? Or, you know, anything like that. And then finally, I've dealt with some patients before who were curious, of course, in the more, you know, quote unquote, natural, holistic, anything, you know, other avenues of management for this. And they're curious whether there's anything supplement wise that they can do to improve this. And one of the more common ones I feel like that I get asked about has to do with selenium supplementation, selenium being an element that has some role in a variety of proteins in our body, has some role in thyroid function. And I will say that there is actually some evidence in the context of selenium supplementation, but the outcomes that are examined typically have to do with like the antibody levels in this thyroid condition tend to be a bit lower in patients taking supplementation. It's not as much a major clinical outcome, meaning something that somebody would feel that is different or an outcome that we would really care about. It's much more these kind of not less clinical, indirect kind of secondary outcome measures, I would say. And so at this point, this is not like routinely recommended. It's not a common element of care, but I just thought it was worth mentioning because if you start Googling for things that you can do, you're very likely to see this mentioned someplace. And then finally, the scenario that is less common in the US, but is more common in the rest of the world is that dietary iodine deficiency. And of course, that would be what you'd want to fix if that were the scenario you're dealing with.
Yeah, there are definitely some case reports out there of people living in the U.S. who do not consume any like fortified food products, don't consume any regular salt because they're like averse to it, you know, yeah. And they develop this sort of like hypothyroidism because mm-hmm. of that, which mm-hmm. is, you know, unfortunately that happens. If we're going to pivot here, and use some more, I don't know, some hot takes that are about to come down the pike here, okay? So we're going to first talk about hypothyroidism and weight management because, again, this is a lot of talking points on the internet. So what is the role of the thyroid in weight management? And we're going to specifically discuss two separate populations here. One, we're going to call euthyroid people. These are folks who have a normal thyroid, whether that's they just don't have any hypothyroidism that needs to be treated, or they do have hypothyroidism that is adequately treated via either levothyroxine or T3 in some cases. That's one population. The other, those are the two populations that we're talking about here. So the main reason for non-medical thyroid use, particularly in sport, is this idea of like modulating weight loss, in particular to prioritize fat loss over muscle loss. This is most common in like image-based sports or physique-based sports like bodybuilding, but also even in weight class sports. So whether it's weightlifting, powerlifting, MMA, or so on. But this has actually been studied. Now, I'll have one study in the citations on this, but there are at least a dozen of these where they actually look at people who do not have hypothyroidism, who are taking various amounts of thyroid supplementation. Do they lose more weight? And of the weight that they lose, is it proportionally more fat mass? And the existing evidence does not support the use of either T4 or T3 for weight loss in euthyroid individuals. In fact, the ATA strongly recommends against it. It has been used. People have used this. Doctors have certainly prescribed it for weight loss. But the problem is the outcomes are not that great. And there are significant risks to giving a euthyroid person particularly high doses of thyroid hormone.
Yeah, if you give somebody enough of a dose, they will certainly lose weight, but you will not enjoy the side effects that come along with it. If it makes you hyperthermic and puts you into atrial fibrillation and reduces your bone density and puts you into heart failure and lots of other complications that you'd rather not have as a bonus on top of your fat loss.
Yeah. Yeah, there's also this thought, particularly in bodybuilding, that, hey, we got to increase the action of testosterone or increase our sensitivity to testosterone because if we give people thyroid hormone, it's going to increase their steroid hormone binding globulin that binds to testosterone, carries it around. And so if that goes up, well, your body's going to make more testosterone or the testosterone that we're injecting is going to be more free to do its thing. But it actually doesn't increase free testosterone when it's actually been measured and actually also tends to increase estrogen levels proportionally more, which is why gynecomastia is sometimes present in those with hyperthyroidism. It's like seen in a number of cases and you're like, if I don't have great evidence to do something, even if it's just for performance and there's a potential like large risk, I'm 10 out of 10 not doing it. And we go back to the case study. The back of the envelope pharmacology and untrained coaches providing like medical guidance, 0 out of 10. Like would not recommend in general.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, another talking point has to do with when people are actively losing weight and like what happens to thyroid function then. And so this can be thought of through like two separate lenses. The first is this like kind of sort of extreme end, which we would consider like relative energy deficiency in sport, the kind of like extreme end of low energy availability. And people get a type of hypothyroidism there, though generally most clinicians would not diagnose this because it's mostly low T3, which is not routinely drawn. And there are inconsistent changes to free T4 and TSH, and it also doesn't warrant therapy. So just because you see this in an individual who's, you know, the person with REDS is generally has other problems related to their endocrine function, whether it's low testosterone in the case of a guy, in the case of a woman, perhaps abnormal menstrual periods, they're at risk for osteoporosis, for example, due to increased bone turnover and a host of other issues. So it's like a transient type of, quote, hypothyroidism, although, again, you wouldn't pick this up on laboratory analysis. But that's the extreme end. That's like very low energy availability for a long time. But what happens with a milder form of, quote, low energy availability, like when people are just losing weight? Does their thyroid, like, you know, crash? Does this, like, affect weight loss outcomes? So it's actually a really interesting study that was done in 2019. They took 34 euthyroid individuals who had a starting BMI with an average of 49.3. Pretty significant BMI there. And they undertook 4 months of diet and exercise. They lost an average of 11 kilograms, about 7 kilos, so that was fat mass. The change in weight was not correlated with changes in TSH, T3, or free T4. And more importantly, there were no significant pre or post differences in thyroid hormone levels. Effectively, the thyroid's there along for the ride. It's not really modulating who is successful and who isn't successful, nor does it like oppose weight loss going forward. Effectively, normal thyroid function, it's like so important to everything that your body has multiple redundant mechanisms in order to like make sure that you're okay.
Yeah, interesting finding. Not terribly surprising. I do think that people, you know, obviously obesity is extremely common. And as far as hormone related disorders go, thyroid disorders are also relatively common. But I think that people more often than not inappropriately link the two and attribute their either obesity or difficulty with losing weight to a thyroid disorder, which is far less common than I think is generally assumed.
Yeah. And again, the weight gain that people see with hypothyroidism in general is mostly from fluid. Doesn't mean that if it's like gone on for a long time and been untreated that they can't gain like fat mass from that as well. But in the short term, particularly when other signs and symptoms start to pop up, it's mostly fluid in that case. Okay, let's move on to like exercise and sports performance. Now, overt or clinical hypothyroidism that's untreated can certainly reduce exercise capacity and performance. You get cramps, fatigue, reduced cardiac output, and reduced muscle strength and power, anemia, all sorts of stuff, right? So these are tend to be corrected when people are replaced or replenish their thyroid hormone levels by taking levothyroxine if that's the appropriate treatment. But it is also used in sport. Now, this I thought was pretty interesting, and maybe here's where the hot takes start coming. So at present, the World Anti-Doping Association does not include thyroid hormone on their prohibited list. They cite that it's due to a lack of plausible evidence that exogenous use outside of medical indications is performance enhancing. However, we saw that it was used for performance enhancing properties in our initial case, and it can be harmful to health. But the thought here is that athletes who train a lot, you know, maybe they're overtrained or on that sort of spectrum for risk of overtraining, hey, maybe they can have some hypothyroidism and then potentially there's some performance benefit and it's not on the WADA banned list. So, hey, let's take it. So are athletes actually taking this? In the most comprehensive data set that we have currently, there were about 16,000 athletes from the Tokyo 2020 Olympics and the Paralympic Games held in 2021. They basically surveyed these people and 40% of them, so just over 6,000, were selected for testing. For these tested athletes, there were 95 declarations for T4 use and 8 declarations for T3 use. Now, this is 1.6% of the sample size, which is higher than the age-matched population that weren't elite-level athletes. And as you might predict, female athletes were 3 times as likely to have a declaration for thyroid hormone, which is effectively the same sort of ratio you see in the general population. So the hot take, and maybe we'll get you to weigh in on this, Austin. For prohibition by the World Anti-Doping Association to make it on their banned list, the code, the WADA code stipulates that you need to meet 2 of the following 3 criteria. So 1, does it actually or potentially have performance-enhancing benefits? 2, is there actual or potential harm to athletes? And then 3, does it violate the spirit of sport? So Austin, what do you think? Should thyroid hormone be on the banned list?
That is an interesting question, and certainly one that I've not thought about until this very second. And if we're going to operate in this world and play this game of, you know, banning drug use in the context of sport, then, you know, just going by those criteria, actual or potential performance enhancement, actual or potential harm, and then whatever is meant by the spirit of sport, I would say you probably would. It feels to me, based on my understanding of the physiology and the pharmacology and everything at play, that they're probably, for, you know, to greater or lesser extent, depending on the sport, a potential performance enhancing effect. There is certainly potential harm if it is dosed inappropriately. And then, yeah, you can say whatever you want regarding the spirit of sport. So I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I follow the same sort of logic here. So I think if taken at high enough doses, particularly for weight class sports or something like that, or where, you know, appearance is certainly, you know, favored for judging, and you could, you know, we could go into all another podcast on that.
Yeah,
probably a potential performance enhancing aspect of it. Even if it doesn't, people certainly, that's why they're using it. Okay. Yeah. Two, certainly can be harmful if used. Spirit of sport, I don't know what that means, but sure. If we were missing the first criteria, like, I could make that argument too. It's like, why are people taking this? You know, is it just to, like, make sure? And it's like, well, then why are you making sure? You're like, oh, because it improves performance. And you're like, well, if nothing else, at bare minimum, I feel like it should be like a one of those things you need a TUE for, therapeutic use exemption, you know, based on overt need for thyroid replacement. And if that means that you get more people being diagnosed with subclinical hypothyroidism and we're taking a little bit of T4 just in case, like, at least then you have some numbers on it and you can monitor folks rather than it operating behind this veil of secrecy, you know, which I don't tend to think is appropriate for most sports.
Yeah, all this stuff is really complicated. I mean, it's a similar, you know, when we talk about people's testosterone levels and with the, you know, the DSD athletes, the, you know, differences in sexual development, they're talking about, like, suppressing their testosterone to certain levels. It's like, do you say that, you know, this is the normal thyroid TSH level that you need to play a sport? And if you have a TUE, you can only treat your TSH down to this level. But if it's less than that, like, that, it's just complicated and not something that I'm prepared to touch myself, but I can just see how complicated that would get real quick. It is straightforward enough to diagnose and treat hypothyroidism, clinical hypothyroidism, into a reasonable TSH range, and that feels very straightforward, and I don't think that that should have implications on your ability to participate in sport. But outside of that, things get murky real fast.
Yeah, I agree. All right, so let's wrap this up on episode 304 of the Barbell Medicine Podcast with Dr. Austin Baracchi. Hypothyroidism means that the thyroid gland is not making enough thyroid hormone to keep the body running as it should. There are many different causes of hypothyroidism, and it can show up in many different ways. The most common cause in developed countries is Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which is a type of autoimmune disease, whereas dietary iodine deficiency is the most common cause in developing countries. Now, neither exercise nor typical weight loss causes hypothyroidism outside of extreme low energy availability that's typically associated with REDS, that's relative energy deficiency in sport. In the absence of other symptoms, weight loss success or difficulties are not generally related to thyroid status. Symptoms of hypothyroidism can vary based on the severity and the age of onset. Now, in adults, symptoms commonly include fatigue, muscle weakness and pain with slow movement, weight gain, again, this is mostly fluid, cognitive dysfunction, constipation, and skin changes. The treatment for hypothyroidism, whether it's overt or subclinical, should be managed by a trained medical professional. Ideally, an individual with hypothyroidism would be returned to a normal or euthyroid state, which usually requires thyroid hormone replacement with levothyroxine, but there are unique situations requiring other management. Dosing should be adjusted based on symptoms and laboratory evidence, again, by a healthcare professional. We recommend working with a healthcare provider if you're concerned about reduced thyroid function. We do not recommend direct-to-consumer thyroid lab testing, much less treatment. Thyroid supplementation in high doses above the normal physiological range carries significant health risks with unclear benefit on performance. Dr. Baracchi, anything you want to add to that?
I think that covers the most important things. So we did it.
There you go. That's a wrap on the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. Special shout out to Dr. Austin Baracchi for joining us here on the podcast. Before you guys go anywhere, though, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast, so we keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. What are your self-care non-negotiables? It's hard to make time for the things that keep you healthy, but being consistent with self-care is like working a muscle. And when life gets crazy, that muscle keeps you strong. Therapy is the ultimate self-care, and BetterHelp makes it easy to get started with affordable online sessions you can do from anywhere. Never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com today to get 10% off your first month.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.